Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name's Brian. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. This is the first time somebody's let me near a podium since speech class in 1986. And in fact, you know, I was nervous to do this. It's the first time I've ever spoken to like this. And it's the first time I've spoken to this many people. And 15 minutes is probably going to seem like a long time and a really short time all at the same time. So this is, you know, this is how it was. How it was I'm really like a lot of you. You know, I started drinking and using drugs when I was very young. And I loved it. And I became the person that was doing that more than all my friends, more than anybody I knew. I thought this is just the bee's knees, and I want to do this as much as I can do it. And the very first time I drank, just, you know, real quick, I got arrested. And that's like, you know, I've heard that so many times. That's like not even unusual. I've heard that out of you guys. You know, you guys are all like that, you know. You know, but that's what happened. And then what started happening really quickly was I kept getting arrested, you know, a lot and a lot and a lot and a lot, and, you know, ended up in solitary. And because I just, juvie wasn't enough, they needed to put me in solitary. And, you know, I viewed all this like they're just trying to break me, and, you know, you're not going to break me, you know. That's how I looked at it. Entirely how I looked at it. There's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. There's nothing wrong with, everything is wrong with you and the way you're viewing me. And, you know, I'm really doing this well. Like, you definitely couldn't do this as well as me, you know. So this continued until I left my house when I was 17 years old. I was out of the house because, you know, They weren't into me doing what I was doing. So I went and found somewhere else to live. And I stopped going to high school because that was in the way of me doing what I wanted to do as well. And eventually I was homeless. And this is really an unusual thing to happen for somebody from, you know, a town of, you know, 25,000 people where I came from. You know, I was really an outlier, you know, the way I was behaving. And it got me into treatment because eventually I was homeless and I was like, you know, I want to go home. And my mom says, well, you can come home if you go to treatment. And I thought, fuck yeah, I'll go to treatment. You know, 30 days, food, you know, warm, all this great shit, you know, and then I get to go home. This is great, you know. And I did that, but what happened was I met some of you there, and that was something I didn't expect to happen. Some people came in, brought meetings, brought a message, and at first I just thought you're all funny, you know. These people were funny, they were kind of cool, they were definitely happier than all the rest of us, you know, on this side. They were the happy people, and they were laughing, and they seemed like they really liked each other. And it was very attractive, honestly. And then they were talking about this spiritual way of life and this way of life that had to do with, you know, these spiritual principles. And this is why they were happy and relaxed. And this was very attractive to me. So I decided that even though I'm not an alcoholic, I'm going to do this thing. And I'm not going to tell them I'm not an alcoholic. I'm going to always tell them, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to do that thing because I want what they have. So I did that till I was 24 and a half. And I went to meetings thinking, I'm not really an alcoholic, but I really dig what these people got going on. And it worked for me. Until one day I thought, you know, I really have missed out on a lot. And maybe I can drink now. I probably could drink even better than those other bozos that didn't do this 6 years of AA. So I asked my friend if I could borrow his car, went to a club, had three drinks, had three beers, danced, tried to get laid, didn't, got in the car, on the way home, put the car around a palm tree. That was my first drink in 6.5 years. That's how it went. And so, you know, every time I tried to drink after that, and I didn't try a lot because it scared me. You know, I was damn scared of that. But every time I did, something really bad happened. So I came to an obvious conclusion, and that is, I suck at this. I suck at drinking. I don't know how these people drink. I don't know how they do it. I can't drink like them. I can't seem to do it. So I should just not do that, and I should do other drugs. Because, you know, the idea of not doing anything, that wasn't something I was going to do. So that's what I did for a long time. And then I moved to Australia. And then in Australia, I wasn't drinking, you know, for the first, you know, few months. And I was given a visa, and I had a great job. And everybody told me, if you don't drink here, you're not going to have any friends. And I thought, yeah, but you don't know me. I'm really like a bull guy. <You know? laughs> That's true for you, but that's not true for me. And they were like, no, for real. Yeah, even you are not going to have any real friends if you don't drink. And you can't just drink. You have to get drunk with these people. This is the culture that is here. And I didn't believe him until, you know, I think about 5 months, and I was like, I don't have any friends, so I need to go get friends. And so I chose a club, and I decided what I was going to do was learn how to drink like everybody else. That's what I was going to do. Again, how do I not know at this point that I'm an alcoholic? It's astonishing to me, after being in these rooms for all those years, and this is what's really amazing to me, and this is something to get, the power of my illness to delude me into thinking that I don't have it is astonishing. What evidence could come up in my life? Such powerful evidence that I'm an alcoholic. And my brain can take that evidence and come up with, I'm obviously not an alcoholic. It's incredible to me now. The power of delusion. You know, the second step talks about insanity and the power to restore us to sanity. You know, and I'm really convinced, in order to get there, one needs to understand they're insane. I needed to understand I was insane. And that's the insanity that was going on, not the insanity of I thought, you know, lollipops were giraffes. Not that kind of insane. The insanity of all the evidence in my life that I'm an alcoholic and me not being able to grasp that fact that was right in front of me. So I tried to learn how to drink, and what happened was I made a lot of friends, made great friends, and I got drunk every night because that's what everybody did. I also learned another little fact about myself. My friends will be the people, just like all of us, anybody in the world, everybody. Our friends are people that live like we do. That's why they're our friends. You know, so the people that I was friends with all my life were people that drank like I drank and used like I used. And I thought that was just the norm. I thought that's how everybody drank and how everybody went through life. Because that's all what I saw. I surrounded myself with those kind of people. So in the end, you know, I came here, I got married, I got a business, you know, and I only got 5 more minutes to tell you about what happened. I got sober, okay? It's incredible what happened. It's truly a miracle. It didn't have hardly anything to do with me whatsoever. I have no idea how you all got sober. None. Because I could not have gotten sober. And I am totally not even exaggerating. I could not get sober. I could not stop drinking. I could not stop. I was coming to these rooms for another 4 or 5 months every day and going home and drinking every day. I could not stop. A lot of you remember that. There's a lot of you that remember me coming to AA. Fucking wreck. Total wreck. But I kept coming, and I kept coming, and I kept coming. It was because I was listening to you guys, and I believed that if it could happen for you, it could happen for me. You know, and my life was on the line. It was as deadly serious as I'm going to die. I'm going to lose. I've lost everything, so the loss and losing part's over. So I'm going to die. So I must either get sober or I'm going to die. Or, you know, and that's probably true for a lot of you. It probably is true for a lot of you. And what I can talk to you about, you know, the last 26 months, or not 26 months, 38 months, so 3 years and 2 months, it's all it's been, is that I've hardly done anything on my own. You know, if you're new or you're still suffering alcoholic, that's the only people I really care about. The rest of you people, this is maybe entertainment, but this is what I'm, right, I'm really talking to you. You know, I didn't do any of this on my own. You know, today I am happy. I have, you know, so I have a job. I have stuff. But mainly I have peace and I have happiness and I have lots of love. And I got a lot of great friends. And I understand how to live and go through life with a lot more grace and a lot more elegance than I ever imagined. You know, but none of this happened just on my own. A bunch of guys just grabbed a hold of me and said, you know, come stick with us. You know, and we worked the steps together. 10 of us went through the book and worked the steps together. It took a year and a half to listen to each other do this. And it was tremendous. You know, I think you all know the basics of this program. But, you know, the really important thing I wanted to get across, though, is that I didn't do this on my own. If you're really still suffering, reach out a hand. All these people, everybody like me, man, I'm dying for you to reach your hand out to me. I want to help. You know, I want to be useful. I want to be able to take what's happened to me and have it make a difference to somebody else's life. And I think 98% of my friends feel exactly the same way. That's how, and I learned it from them. I didn't make it up myself. I learned it from all these other people. You know, so reach out. You know, get a gang, and do this thing together. I don't really know what there's not much I can think of to say. You know, I can tell you about, you know, we're going to step or something profound or, you know, pray. I think you all know all that, you know, but the most important thing when I thought about what I would talk about today is, you know, don't try and do it alone. It can't be done alone. And that by me relying on other guys and relying on my higher power, and I mean relying on my higher power and other people, not just guys, but there's plenty of women that have helped out too. I mean, you know, plenty. But this is something that we do together. And, you know, so I hope that you reach out and you find people to do this together with. All right, cheers.
Okay, I'm really nervous here. this is my second time speaking, so forgive me if I'm just going to try to do this right. Okay, first of all, my name is Kirsten, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kirsten.
My home group is Four Horsemen. It's held every Wednesday at 7:30 to 8:30 in Fremont Baptist Church. And I have a sponsor, Victoria B., who also has a sponsor, who has a sponsor. My sobriety date is July 6th. 2013. So what it was like, I'm trying to keep this part short because the last time I only gave myself like 2 minutes to get sober. So, so I was always an escapist. I really loved books. I didn't really want to be in reality ever. And I'll just skip ahead to like my first drink. I was 14. I was with a friend and we went up the street and this kid, who had designs on her really wanted to, get us drunk so he could make out with her and whatever. So we had some cherry brandy and then we snuck back into my house and, I continued to drink with her and mainly I didn't really like it. I did it to relax and be social and so that I could get away with doing stupid things that I wanted to do anyway, but really couldn't justify doing. While sober. Let's see. When I was 15, I kind of got into pot and I mostly left drinking behind for quite a while. Started doing psychedelics when I was 16 and then I didn't really drink that much. I mean, I would drink at parties in high school and I would usually throw up. And then when I was 23, I decided that I wanted my life to be a little bit bigger than my living room, my couch, my TV, and my bong. So I wanted to, I started drinking with people at work. And shortly thereafter, I moved to Austin, Texas, and I got a whole new social life, and that included drinking. And I really think that my drinking was pretty normal. It was more like, wasn't like one of those like bad out of hell alcoholics. I was like the frog in the water. Like you just turn up the heat slowly and that's kind of how it happened until then it really happened until the water started boiling. But, so, I got a job as a bartender when I was about, I guess I was 25 and I drank every time I was at work. I got drunk when I was at work because that's what everyone else did. And how else do you deal with drunks, but get drunk? And then when I was 29, I joined roller derby and I started drinking even more. It was part of the culture. It was a lot of fun. That's what all my friends were doing. And again, I wanted to be, accepted. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to, be able to be in social environments without feeling just completely at a loss. I don't think that things really started to get out of hand. I wasn't really drinking. I don't know. I was binge drinking a lot. But at a certain point, I started drinking because I felt like it was a solution as opposed to a tool. And then when I broke up with my boyfriend in like early 2005 and it was devastating to me. And I just started partying. I started going at it full throttle. I was back in school at this point. I was freaking out because, my perfectionism had just like totally gotten a hold of me. And, I'd lost sight of who I was. I had no idea. And I thought that the answer was to look for it in the way that I saw other people found their happiness, or that's what I thought. And I was going to school. I was using my loans to pay my bar tabs and buy Coke, and I was just completely lost. And I graduated from school just barely, with really poor grades. Like there were semesters where I barely passed and I only got like one, like three credits because I just couldn't. And that was like my second go round and I had promised that I would really do well that time. I quit doing Coke in like 2007 and I went to this like, it was like a therapy boot camp kind of thing. And, you know, some of these people had the nerve to suggest that maybe if I cut down on my drinking that my life would be better. And I was just like, you Bible-beating jerks. Like, I don't know who you think you are, but that is not my problem. This is like, it's life, it's, you know, you know, the guys that I'm that I'm going out with, like, my friends were always like, well, you can't find, like, decent guys because your picker is broken. And I really believed that. I really did. And so what happened was I left Austin when I graduated school. I was going to make my way in the world. I was going to I was really going to go somewhere with my career. I was never going to wait tables again. And I traveled to Santa Fe. I traveled to Chicago. I traveled to Ashland, Oregon, and I worked at a bunch of different theaters with varying results, but there was always something really, like, it would be either a personal situation or a professional situation that would just be so messed up that I would just have to drink. And, you know, after I left Austin, I didn't have any friends anymore, and so I would end up just, like, all I had was, like, my dog and my cat and booze. And I left Ashland in disgrace, pretty much. I had gotten tendonitis really bad, and I didn't, even though the doctor told me that, you know, inflammation is oftentimes caused by drinking, I didn't stop drinking. So I moved to Seattle, and I lost a job. I didn't attribute that to drinking, because that wasn't what it was. Basically, I was dating somebody, and we were going to go on a camping trip. And I decided that I needed a box of wine for an overnight camping trip, even though I already had, like, this bottle of rum. And we hiked in, and we got in a fight, and I was drunk, and the fight escalated, and he made me go back to the car so he could drive me home. And while we were sitting in the car, I was just like, I was drunk. And there was no one sitting in the back seat, but I heard this voice that said, "Kirsten, you drink too much." And I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, I think I drink too much. And he was, I won't take his inventory, but he qualifies to be here. He was just like, whatever, girl. And so the next day I was very upset, and my neighbor took me to a meeting, and she told me that she had been very concerned, and she made me promise to go to 6 meetings in 6 weeks. And the first meeting I went to, I didn't think I should be there. But then the speaker said, one of the people that shared said something that really, like, hit home with me. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I could go to another meeting. Then the next meeting I went to the Ballard Basket, and this woman approached, I cried through the entire thing. I was really angry that everyone seemed so happy, and they were laughing. And I thought that, like, when I quit drinking, that everything would just kind of magically get better if that was really my problem. But I felt like someone had peeled my skin off. And this woman came up to me, and she was like, "Here's my number. I want you to call me every day." And I was like, "No, you're, like, this bossy old lady. You need to leave me alone." But I kept going to meetings because I had promised, and because I didn't know what else to do. I was really, really overwhelmed and freaked out, and I just didn't know what to do with myself. I spent a lot of time just at my house by myself. So I finally got a sponsor, and that didn't really work out. She was the sponsor of the kind that I wanted, where I could only call her, like, 2 days out of the week, because she was out of town the rest of the time. And that sounded perfect, but then it ended up not being perfect when I needed to get in touch with somebody. And I work in the restaurant industry, and I was going to wine tastings, and I was actually tasting the wine. And, you know, there was, like, the bar manager there where I worked was an alcoholic, and he would taste things and spit them out. So I thought, well, that was fine. I could also do that. But that ended up in a couple of relapses. And then I got fired from that job. And it was shortly after that that I got a new sponsor. Oh, no, I guess I got her, like, right before. And she was kind of a drill instructor. she was like, "You got to call me every day." And she wanted me to do things like be on time when I met, you know, when she agreed to meet me. And that made me really mad for a long time. But, you know, I think that, like, I started working the steps with her. And I guess the first step was like really and truly accepting that I was an alcoholic, which was really hard for me. I don't have time to go through all the steps, but okay. So I guess what I'd like to say now is that I am not the poster child for AA and all the things that it can bring you. I oftentimes pull the half measures thing. And because of that, and because I have actually worked the program effectively, I feel at points in my life, I can tell a real difference between when I'm actually working the steps and working my program and when I'm not. And I'm sorry, I get so emotional. So recently, like I was up to step 9 and I have been on it for a long time. I've made some pretty substantial amends, I think, some like really big ones. I've tackled the big ones, and including because of this program, I was able to go home and help my mom out when she broke her leg earlier this year. And I never would have been able to do that without this program. I was really, really resentful towards her because of the way things went when I was a kid. And it's only been recently and through this program that I've been able to see my part in our relationship and to forgive her and really and truly espouse or just absorb the knowledge that, you know, my parents did the best they could. They couldn't give what they didn't have. And so I've gone back to 6 and 7, and that's kind of where I am now, is working with character defects. And before, I just kind of thought that I was a piece of crap because I wasn't blonde, I wasn't taller, I wasn't cool enough. And now I know I'm not a piece of crap, but you know, it's this opportunity to improve my character that's really made this growth. It's like a growth opportunity. And I think that I would never have even considered anything like that. I mean, I read a ton of self-help books. I was just like, yeah, I've read them. Why am I not better? Why isn't my life perfect? Like, I've read enough books to, you know, to fill a library. But it was really through this program that I've been able to make some strides. I've gotten, you know, despite some half measures when I am working the program, my life is so much easier. And when they say that, like, we'll be able to instinctively know what to do in situations which used to baffle us, that in itself for me is such a gift. Like, I don't know everything, but sometimes I know. And because sometimes I know when I never used to know, that to me is like hope. It's like real hope. It's based on something real. And I know that there is a solution. If you're new here, please keep coming back. I don't know if this talk has inspired anyone, but you can find hope in these rooms, and this program works if you work it. But you got to work it. It's like going to the gym. You can't just sit on the bicycle and read magazines. So thank you.
Hi, my name is Alex, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really nervous because I care about what you think of me, even though I don't know you. I was trying to explain that earlier. Anyways, so I'll just get started. I grew up in a alcoholic home. My father drank a lot. My mom suffers from the ism, but she doesn't have the physical allergy. My home was really, really chaotic, but there was a lot of love in my home. So much love. My first drink was when I was 12. Oh, let me back up. My birthday is May 22nd. This time around, I haven't really focused a lot on like what my birthday is or what the anniversaries are, because I realized that this disease is going to kill me, and I have to do it one day at a time. So May 22nd, 2014 is my birthday. I have a sponsor and I have a home group, more than one. Anyways, so I, my first drink was when I was 12. It was Christmas time. I have a really big German family. And I started off with like a sip of these peppermint schnapps. They're disgusting. And I remember that, just like, just the memory of it. It was just, I was repulsed. And then I got that feeling, that euphoria, you know, it's just like this wave hit me of just like, whoa, there's a whole nother way to do this. I got this. Like, I have arrived and I'm only 12. And then I proceeded after that, like I couldn't stop. I was like going around the party, like taking sips of like other people's, you know, glasses and drinks. And then I blacked out. And then I came to, and I was sitting at the dinner table. I don't know how I got there. And we were all saying grace, and then I projectile vomited all over my dinner plate in front of everybody while they were all praying. And what's really funny about that is, like, my family's, like, actually, like, really, like, really, like, staunch atheists. And I was like, why is everyone praying? Like, what are we, what kind of show are we putting on for each other? Like, what is this? So, and then I went around the entire house that night vomiting all over the place, all over myself, crying, just, And that is exactly how every single one of my drinks after that was, unless I was trying to control it. And I could never control and enjoy my drinking, ever. It was one or the other. I was either going completely buck wild, or I was, like, monitoring, like, okay, I think it's been 2 minutes. I'll take a sip. Okay, put it down. And eyeing everybody's drink, I was miserable. I was not, I didn't drink for many, many years in high school. I was dry. I had discovered cross-country running. I got a scholarship to go to college, and I did that through getting this scholarship. And I went to, as soon as I went to college, it was like on. It was just on. I realized that, like, I could eat whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted to. I could drink whenever I wanted, whenever I wanted to. I could go to parties. I could stay up late. I could do, I just screw school, you know. And that's what I did. And I did that for a really, really long time until, and then, like, it started, I noticed for me, other people had noticed and had always mentioned, like, that's a, you've had a few drinks. And even then I'd be like, this is nothing, really. I'm actually toned back, dialing this down. And then I think I had, like, tried to monitor or, like, alter my drinking around, like, age 20 or so. I was like, oh, I'll pick up yoga. I'll get, you know, spiritual. And didn't work out. I kept drinking. I couldn't. Once I started, I realized, I don't know what age I was, but I realized I couldn't stop once I started. And it didn't matter what I drank, I couldn't, the allergy was in me, was like, I just couldn't stop. I was so powerless. And it didn't frighten me. Like, I was like, okay. And I guess after that, like, I had done the thing where I really tried to stop and start and, you know, whiskey to beer or whatever. I didn't like beer so much because I was worried about getting fat and super vain. And one day my dad died. He had been diagnosed with cancer, and he and I were very, very close. He's a big part of my story. And the anniversary of his death was actually last month. I don't know what happened, but something in me, like the fatality of life and like this person that I had held so dear, was like ripped out of the world like so quickly for me. And I was just so pissed. And I went across the world. I went to Bali, Indonesia to try and like deal with this. And I thought like, okay, I'll stop drinking. Like, I'm all right. And I couldn't. I was all the way across the world trying to cope with this loss and like trying to quit drinking. And I couldn't. Like, it was so bizarre to me that, like, I'd wake up in the morning in paradise, you know, just beautiful beaches and temples everywhere and just fresh food and markets and the people were amazing. And I couldn't stop drinking. Like, I had had all these outside things, and all these outside things were supposed to make me happy, and they weren't. And I got back to America, and I was driving home drunk one day, which I did frequently, and I had a 3-month-long blackout. Like, there's 3 months where I don't remember any, like, I remember, like, I got dental work, and that's it. Like, I was at my mom's house some, but all that is, like, gone. That's how long the blackout lasted. And I was driving home drunk, and I hit an ambulance with someone inside of it, and they were trying to get help, and I almost killed them. And that's what it took for me to get sober. Actually, it didn't. I went around the corner and got drunk. And then a couple days later, I was standing around in my room, and I was thinking, like, okay, if I had $1 million, I would go to treatment and get a personal trainer, like the vanity, right? And in that moment, I heard all of this glass break. And I was like, what is that? I turned and looked around, and this Buddha that my father had given me had fallen off the windowsill and had broken every single one of my wine glasses, and I got sober. After that, I was like, oh, maybe this is a sign. And so my journey in recovery has not been a linear experience. I used to think very, like, black and white, and I used to think that it had to be this linear thing, that, like, if I did one thing once, I would never do it again, and I'd learn from it, and I'd just get, like, up on this mountaintop, and that's just, like, not recovery for me. For me, it's, like, this very, like, cyclical thing, and, like, I go through phases, and different things get brought up along the way. The one constant that has been there is this relationship with a higher power. I choose to call it God. It's easier. You guys get it. You know what I mean? What I'm thinking of God may not necessarily be what you guys are thinking of God. It's just a very easy way for me to say it. Or I could say HP, but I just say God. So when I came into the rooms, I was so repulsed by the word God that I actually went through my big book with my sponsor, as outlined. And every time that word was in the book, I took a black permanent marker and I crossed it off. And I wrote in what I wanted to call my higher power. And I couldn't even do that at first. I was, like, so angry at God. I was so angry at God, this God that, like, you know, years of abuse that I endured as a young girl, and then taking away the one thing that I loved and held so dear, you know. And I was just furious. And then one day my sponsor told me that that had nothing to do with God, and that that was man's will. And I don't know, it just, something in me clicked. It was just like, wait, all of those years I spent blaming God for all this stuff, it had nothing to do with God. It had everything to do with me and my relationships with people. Oh, like, well, I've been doing it wrong. And and there was a lot of freedom for me in that I could choose whatever I wanted to make my higher power. And you know what? My higher power also hasn't been the same thing. I've really had to reevaluate my relationship with my higher power and what I view my higher power as. Because sometimes I still go back to this whole dogmatic idea that God is, you know, punishing me. I'm a bad girl. Like, I've done something wrong. You know, I littered, you know, so now I'm going to, you know, and get all this karma, and I'm going to be punished. So I go back and forth, and, like, I have to do these, like, spot check inventories with myself and God, where I'm like, oh, okay, like, that's an old idea. That's, like, something my parents told me, or that's something I heard growing up. Like, that isn't what I choose to worship, and that isn't what I choose to believe in. So backing up a little bit, I actually, I was sober for almost 3 years. Memorial Day weekend, I decided one day at work, like, the allergy had been ignited. I'd moved across the country to Texas. I moved a lot of, I'm a geographic alcoholic. I like to think that if I go somewhere else, I'm going to be cured. It's not true. I'm not actually exactly who I am all the time, no matter where I go. And I'll get that temporary high. It's the same thing, right? It's the same thing as drinking. I get that temporary high, that temporary fix. I'm like, oh, I'm in Mexico. This is amazing. I'm a different person. I've arrived. And then all of a sudden, like, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm still me. So I went to Texas, and I decided to live there. And I was working for this really big, like, catering company, and, like, cooking for celebrities, and just, you know, kind of engaging in this really bad behavior for me, or not bad, but unhealthy behavior around work. Where I was working, like, 20-hour shifts and sleeping, like, 2 or 3 hours a night, and then getting up and working another 20-hour shift. You know, I was trying to get that financial insecurity filled through outside sources. But when really, you know, like it says in the book, and what I've come to realize today is that God is my employer. really, truly, I have to do that all the time. I'm like, okay, if I mess up at work, I'm like, that's right, God, you're my employer. All right. And like, sometimes I'll actually like physically like put my hands up because I need that for myself. I don't know. One day, I had stopped going to meetings when I was in Texas. I was cured. I had a boyfriend. I had everything I needed, right? I had this job. I was on top of the world. And I went out. It was so easy. It was so easy. And I was out for exactly a year, which was really strange. Because my rock bottom this last time wasn't as intense. There was no, like, glass breaking and, like, voice from the sky. I had woken up at a coworker's house, and I had clothes on. And the last memory I had, I did not. So I was like, oh, God, here it is again. That waking up, like, you know, the four horsemen, you're just like, oh, my God, like, where am I? How did I get here? What did I do? And in that moment, I just knew. I was like, I have to go back. I have to go back to AA. Before I did that, I took many shots of tequila and went to work. And I was like, this will do. But, yeah, I got a sponsor right away, and I immediately started working the steps. And this time, I experienced there was no pink cloud. I was not feeling it. And I worked the steps like I was dying because I had realized like how easy it was for me to go out. It's just so easy and effortless. And so this time around has been a completely different experience. You know, I've worked the steps in a couple of different programs since I've been here. I think the 12 steps can be applied to like any area of my life. I'm of service today. I guess I'll talk about like a regular day for me. A regular day for me is I wake up and I immediately pray. Sometimes I pray in bed. Sometimes I get on my knees. I feel like God understands. You know, my human mind likes to tell me I'm being a bad person because I'm not getting on my knees every single morning and every single night. And that's something like that I continually have to work on is not using AA as a whipping tool. And so sometimes I pray in bed and sometimes I pray on my knees. I chant in the morning. And I run as a form of meditation. That's when I get to talk to God. All my complaints. You know what I mean? I've been storing them up all day. You know, writing them out and then sending them to my sponsor each night. Sometimes isn't enough, you know? So I like to get, my word in. But I feel like my higher power can handle that. My God understands that. My God made me this way on purpose. And I want to have a relationship with my God that feels authentic to me because I spent my entire life pretending I was something that I wasn't because I thought you would like me better. The reality is I have no control over you. And the only thing I can manage is like just trying to enhance my relationship with God. Start there and then go to meetings and be of service. I have a lot of people that I check in with. I read daily readers when I get back from my run. I read daily readers. I go into work. I read 84 through 86. And I'm also reading like the history of AA right now, or AA comes of age. I read that in between breaks. My sponsor has me working on a lot of projects. And then throughout the day, I'm usually staying in contact with someone in AA, more than one person, usually many. And I have a sponsee. I actually just got done working with her right before I came here. And I feel like kind of stunned. It's like AA overload, but it feels really good. It's wonderful. There's no other way I would have it at this point. And then at the end of the night, I do an inventory and then I take pictures of it and I email it to my sponsor. That way, like my garbage doesn't sit with me because, that was an easy way I went out last time. And that's my time and that's what I do. Thank you.
My name is Jeff. I am an alcoholic. Yeah. My sobriety date is 2/14/2012. My home group is the Four Horsemen group, which meets Wednesdays at 7 at Fremont Baptist Church. I am also a regular attendee of Queen Anne Study on Sundays. I invite you to come out to those. I have a sponsor, and I have sponsees. And this is not my first time doing the program. And I want to talk a little bit about that. They say it takes what it takes, and I don't know why that is. It just is the way that it is. I turned 49 about 2 weeks ago, and one of the things that I hear a lot from people my age in rooms is statements like, I wish I'd got this sooner, or in my case, I wish I'd kept it when I did have it. And I thought about that a lot when I got sober this time. I had 7 years. I was out for a year, and then I had 5 years. And then I didn't actually go out so much as I just stopped going to AA, and there's a reason for that. But so when I got sober this time, I asked myself what was going to be different. And I've looked really long and hard at the path that I've taken to where I'm at today. I guess my first step really begins in 2005 on my 39th birthday. I was on my way home from work. I had, in my mind at least, I was sober and I had arrived. I managed a print shop. I made good money. I'd been married about 10 years. Had a 4-year-old daughter. And really, I was incredibly unhappy, and I'm not really certain why, but it's kind of unimportant. On the way home, I was in an accident. I rode a motorcycle at the time. Had I been in a car, it would have been a fender bender, but that's not the way it worked out. As a result of that accident, I lost my left foot. This is obviously a momentous event in my life, and I didn't drink over it at the time, and I don't know why. I don't know why that is, and it's something I thought about a lot, and I don't really have an answer for that. But the next, 3 years would have a lot of impact in my world. About 2 years after that, my marriage fell apart, mostly as a result of my accident, and I left. And then 6 months after that, in March of 2009, I lost my job, like a lot of people did in the market crash. Even at that point, I still didn't drink. I went into an extremely deep, deep, deep depression. And I didn't work for almost 2 years after that. And it was a really rough time. And I was doing largely what I thought I could in order to maintain my life. I was seeing a psychiatrist at the time. I was seeing a counselor at the time. I was trying to keep my life together. What I wasn't doing is I wasn't coming here. I wasn't going to AA. The reason for that at the time was that as of my accident, I thought, you know what? If this is what God has in store for me, if this is what my sobriety life has in store for me, not interested. Done with it. I'll just not drink and not come. And so about this time, something started creeping into my thought that that I wasn't really truly an alcoholic. And I didn't realize that I had done this. In the past, when I had been in AA, I had been very, very involved. I had home groups, I had service positions, I had sponsees, some of whom are still sober today. And I would go through, and there's 4 chapters, if you include the doctor's opinion, where it talks about what it is to be an alcoholic. And I would read through these with guys, and I would look at it, and I would go, well, you know, I never did that, and I never did that. I did that, and I never did that, but it did that and that and that. And so, and I didn't think this consciously, but I was like, you know, I'm only 3/8 of an alcoholic. I didn't realize that was actually at the core of what was happening. It says in the big book that we must concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. And that's what it says the first step is. And I was unable to do that. So I was out in 2010, October of 2010. I was out playing music with some friends. And I was having some dinner before the show. And I thought, you know what? A whiskey and Coke would go great with this burger. And that went so well, I repeated the experiment the following week. And so the second week, it was about 3 drinks, you know, and that one went so well, I decided to try the home version. And I bought some whiskey on the way home. And it was about 3 weeks before I was by myself in my basement until 3 a.m, every single night, drinking a pint to a fifth. And I was pounding my fist on my desk because I wasn't at the bar, thinking, you know, how did this happen? Oh, well, I might as well do this now. That year, I drank for an entire year. I was going to school. I was getting decent grades, 3.7. I was doing all right. I was keeping it all hidden. Nobody really knew. I don't have a whole lot of direct repercussion for my drinking. I've never blacked out. I'm not violent. I'm not a Jekyll and Hyde, hence the I didn't do this, that, and the other thing. Never switch. It's always whiskey. But I was alone, and I was lonely, and I was miserable. And I got to the point where I didn't even want to be around the people that I care about. And I certainly didn't want them to know about what I was doing. When the holidays of 2011 came around, I was on break from school, and I was largely at home alone. My girlfriend at the time is a Dickens caroler, so she was gone morning till late at night every single day through December. And I was left to my own devices, and I started drinking really heavily because I didn't have anything else to do. And at the end of the holidays, I decided this is really bad. I need to get myself in control. And I decided that I was going to do whatever it took to not drink. And I initially started by trying to not drink on my own, and that kind of failed miserably. And when things got really desperate and I had to do something terribly, terribly desperate, I decided, you know what? I'm going to do the answer. I'm going to go to AA. So I went every day. There's a meeting that meets about two blocks away from where I lived at the time. They meet twice every single day. And so I decided to go to the 5 o'clock meeting, and I couldn't make it. I could not get to 5 o'clock without drinking. I thought, okay, this is fine. I got this one handled. I'll just go to the noon meeting. I couldn't make it till noon. So it talks about in the big book about needing, some of us need to get physically removed from our addiction. And it turns out that that's actually what I needed to do. And so I made arrangements to go into treatment. I went to Highline Addiction Recovery. And here's where it gets sort of, well, for me, interesting. I had no money and I had no insurance. And my girlfriend at the time was willing to pay to send me to treatment. So I made arrangements, I got all the numbers sussed out, it was $5,000 to go to treatment. And so I got on the bus on a Saturday, when I got ready to leave, she said, go get well, hurry back. I got down there and they said, no, you drink way too much, we're going to have to send you through detox. And so I had to call her up from the admission place and say, you know what, it's not going to be $5,000, it's actually going to be $10,000. Right. And she agreed. I was not privy to this conversation, but she agreed. So I went into detox on the 10th of February on Valentine's Day. I want you to sit with me on this one. On Valentine's Day, which was my last day in detox, I called my girlfriend up and said, I love you, honey. Happy Valentine's Day. And she was quiet. And I said, are you going to say anything? And she said, I don't ever want to talk to you again. Do not call me, I will not answer. Do not leave a message, I will not listen. Do not write me, I will not read it. I'm going to sell everything that you own in order to help pay for some of the cost of what you have cost me in order to send you to treatment. And I'm in treatment now, and I'm starting to, yeah. And I'm starting to wade through some of my first step. And four chapters, they talk about all this stuff about how people drink and what it is to be an alcoholic and all this kind of stuff. And it all gets boiled down, not there, but in this paragraph that they inserted, you know, which I never read before, but they inserted into the We Agnostics. At the very beginning, it says, if when you really want to stop, you cannot stop, or once having started, cannot control the amount you drink. And I thought, holy crap, excuse me, for the first time, that's me. I really get it. I could not stop on my own. The next thing was that I couldn't do it on my own, and I couldn't do it here in the rooms with you people. I couldn't just sit down, go to meetings, and not drink in between. I needed help from a higher power. And in my mind, I thought that step two was all about, you know, what God is and where God can be found and what God means and all that kind of stuff. Once again, there's a little sentence in We Agnostics that totally boils down step two, at least for me. It says, do I now believe or am I willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? Being in treatment, I had to know that there was a power greater than myself, right? So I'm done one and two now. And I'm in the middle of three, and I didn't know it at the time. I called all my friends. I said, yeah, my girlfriend's selling all my stuff. Just so you get a picture of this, we're talking four guitars, three basses, three amps, three keyboards, two drum sets, 2,500 CDs, 300 books, most of which were first editions, signed. And I wanted that stuff so bad, I had to get it back. And I'm like, I'm calling my friends up, and I'm saying, can you talk to her? Can you get this? Can you make sure she doesn't sell that? Make sure she gets this much for that item? And I was talking to my counselor, and he said to me, he said, what's really important to you right now? He said, I know that this stuff's important to you, but what's the primary thing that you're dealing with right now? And I said, you know, the truth is, I really just don't want to drink anymore. And he said, so getting your stuff back, if you leave here or you spend all your energy doing that, is that really going to help facilitate your sobriety? And I sat with that for a couple of days, and I thought, what happens if I really don't have any of that stuff when I come out of here? And I thought, you know what? This is more important, and this is better. I will take sobriety. I will take the loss of the lack, you know, the desire to drink. I just wanted to be rid of that so bad. So I get to the end. It's a Wednesday. On Thursday, I'm getting ready to leave. And I'm talking to my counselor again. I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. I got no place to go. I got no job. I got no money. And he said, okay, well, what are you going to do? I don't know. He said, no, really, literally, you're going to leave here tomorrow with your bag of stuff and that's it. What are you going to do? And I went, oh, I guess I'll go to a meeting, find some food, and find a place to stay. And he said, that's a great idea. Why don't you try doing that the next day, too? And that's literally what I did. That's how I walked out of treatment. I called my mom up and asked to stay at her place, which she graciously agreed to. She lives in elderly housing, so it was a little studio apartment with an alcove, and she let me sleep on her floor. I got in touch with Oxford House, and I borrowed $200 from my brother for the non-refundable deposit, which was pretty amazing considering the fact that I hadn't talked to him in probably 2 years. And he just said, yeah, no problem. I went to Oxford. I said, I want to live here. They said, that's great. You have to pay this month's rent and next month's rent by the end of the month, or we're going to ask you to leave. And so I went out and I found some work. I got a job through LaborWorks working in a glass recycling place. I spent 12 hours a day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, wading through 15-foot mounds of glass, cleaning up and, you know, covered in head to foot. I got a respirator and goggles, and I'm told because there's glass dust everywhere. And, you know, I'd be pulling rubbers and needles and napkins out of this, knee-deep in glass, and I'm just thinking, I can't do this. This is horrible. This is where alcoholics go when they die. You know, I'm pulling, oh, there's a needle. Oh, there's a rubber. Oh, look, a Crown Royal cap, you know. So I would go in on a Friday morning and I would say, you know what, I can't do this. I physically can't do it. My leg's screwed up. I'm on my feet all day. It's rough work. I cannot do this, but I need the money, so I'll make it to break. So I would make it to break, and I'd get a respite, and I'd go, okay, you know what, I can make it to lunch. That's fine. So I would make it to lunch, and then I'd be like, well, you know what, I can make it to the end of the day, but that's it. I'm not coming back on Saturday. Skip that. That's toast, you know. And then the day would get done, and I would go home, and I'd think, you know what, if I leave, if I don't come back the next day, they can't get anybody because LaborWorks is closed, and there's only two other guys on the floor. So not only am I starting to realize what's important for me, I'm starting to get out of myself too. And so I would go back in and I did the same thing again. I did that for 2 months, quitting every single day. My life is really not much different today. It's better. I like my job more. And I have all of you people. And that's a wonderful thing. But I still live it in that moment by moment, kind of this is what I need to be doing right now. This is what's really important to me right now. This is what I need to do until the next thing comes along and makes itself evident. I'm really glad to be here. I don't know why it takes what it takes, but I wouldn't wish for a different past because everything that has happened has made me who I am and has brought me to where I am today, and there's no place I would rather be. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.